Sometimes in life, you realize that the best metric for success is following your gut. In the case of Dara Brustein, her gut feelings and tenacity for entrepreneurship got her through some pretty tough times.
But I will say, I think like you talked about how entrepreneurship is often thought of as so romantic and sexy, and it's not often or always that way. So I want to be really clear that even though we've been in this for 10 years and now we're in 38 states and we feel really successful in all of the conventional terms, it was a real struggle for a long ass time, to the point where even 2-3 years in, when I had thought we'd finally gotten over that hurdle and we had the income coming in and it's a residual based business, so you can kind of predict it and expect it to come, some of our, like, I remember particularly one whale of a client who was, I'm embarrassed to say, about 80% of our revenue pulled. We were back to square one almost.
Also on this week's episode, we discuss how to live by making a living, following your instinct, and accepting uncertainty. And now, episode 16 of Culturation.
Good evening, my fellow citizens.
Are you ready? The main event of the evening.
The ideas.
It's the word that you put in.
The ability.
Can you dig it?
The talent.
I'm going to show you how great I am.
Those who influence, the entertainer, the business leader, and the entrepreneur, they're all right here on Culturation. And now, your host, Justin Epstein.
Welcome to Culturation. I'm your host, Justin Epstein. On this week's episode, we speak with life architect, Dara Brustein. Equal parts teacher, connector, and founder, Dara stands for entrepreneurial empowerment. In the fall of 2018, Dara launched Life by Design, Not by Default, sharing stories with visionaries like Deepak Chopra, Adam Grant, and Jen Sincero in a 45-speaker online summit reaching over 7,000 people. For the past 10 years, she founded and scaled two businesses in tandem, a networking events company serving 30,000-plus people, and a payment processing company spanning 38 states. A prolific writer and interviewer, Dara's thought leadership articles on lifestyle design have been read by over 1 million people across Forbes, Entrepreneur, and Thrive Global. Her motivating motto, build a life of your own, a career to fund it, and a network to support it, has inspired thousands to reach higher and dream bigger. Her core belief is that the best way to live is by design, not by default. She spent the last decade crafting and integrating her life and work intentionally, not choosing one over the other. Most recently, Dara launched the video series, Diving Deep with Deepak and Dara, to make deep topics relatable and translatable into your life. With that being said, I'd like to welcome my good friend, Dara Brustein, to the show today. Dara, thanks for coming on today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
This is my second take. This has happened twice now where I cannot pronounce a name, but I do have baby brain, like you said. So.
Yeah, I love that you're not pregnant, but we are giving you the leniency.
Thank you. My wife is due in 2 days, so I have a little bit of leniency here. So for those that may not be familiar with you, what you do, there is a lot to talk about. So if you can try to condense it, how would you best explain who you are and a little bit about yourself?
I think anyone who can't see it right now, you can maybe attest to the fact that I look in pain because I'm like, I don't have that. It's like the most backwards. I talk about building relationships and I'm like, I don't even know how to introduce myself. The most basic way to describe what I do is I'm an entrepreneur and a writer. More specifically, I own a handful of businesses, one in electronic payments, one in networking events for young professionals, and a children's book series that I wrote on financial literacy education. And then in the most recent incarnation of my career, I create a shit ton of content on designing your life, building a career or business to fund it, and a network to support it.
So not that much?
Just very little.
Okay. All right. So a little bit of this
and
that.
I'm trying hard to work harder.
Well, so it sounds like you've pretty much built quite a resume and you're going to continue growing it. I want to kind of go back to how it all started, though. You were born, raised, I think, outside of Philadelphia. Is that correct?
Yes.
On a historic horse farm. I don't know what that means, but
damn,
I think of like Fixer Upper.
This guy did his homework. Yeah, Fixer. I wish we were on Fixer Upper. That'd be so cool. It was historic horse farm in the sense that the town was built around it. It, when I lived there, it was over 100 years old. So now it's 100 plus, like 130 years old. And it was pretty cool. It was like historically a buffalo farm and it roamed free. And then, you know, my parents came in and subdivided and
okay.
Things changed.
What made them go there?
My father's work was generally the thing that spurred moves, which we did a couple of, but they're both from Connecticut. They had lived in Buffalo and then they came to the Philadelphia area for his work in financial services.
Okay. So as a kid growing up on a horse farm, what was that like?
Well, the irony was, is I never learned to ride a horse.
Okay.
Whereas my mom at one point was a professional equestrian.
Makes sense.
You have a barn at your disposal and you've got horses at your avail. And I would pet them and feed them and look at them and they were beautiful. But I actually never learned to ride.
Okay.
But it was fun. Actually, I remember being a kid who really thrived on the explorative mindset that you got when you had acres and acres of property. And I have two brothers. One is my twin. So I always had people my age around, especially with, you know, being a twin, there's friends constantly at your house. And it was really fun. You got to exercise your imagination and play in the fields and pet the animals. And we just made up so many pretend games that actually, I don't know where this came from, but it's sparking in my mind of mice and men, like Lenny in the barn, petting the animals and hopefully me not squeezing them to death.
Correct,
is like basically my childhood.
Wow. You know, it's interesting because you see people grow up in all different surroundings, and those that grow up in country or farms or outside areas when you have nothing but time, it seems like time is both your greatest advantage and disadvantage in a lot of ways, in the sense that you can imagine, you can dream, and these things become very clear visions versus somebody that may be exposed to, let's say, growing up in New York or major cities where there's a lot of noise around them and very hard to kind of hone in or focus.
Yeah, as a kid, I don't think you know the difference, right? Like your circumstance is the thing that you think is normal. So I just thought, oh, every kid grows up something like this. Although all of my friends lived in the quintessential neighborhood where they could walk three doors down, knock on the door, and have a play date.
Yeah.
And I was so envious of that. I would often sneak on the bus home to go home with them because it was way more fun to have all of that interactivity and that community. But my house was the house they all wanted to come to because we had the land and the horses and a pool. And it just felt really exploratory.
Nice. So as a kid, weren't an equestrian per se, but you pet the animals, you had a good time. What else was kind of interest to you as a child growing up?
So as a kid, the thing I wanted most in the world was to be both Cindy Crawford, not like Cindy, but I wanted to be Cindy Crawford, okay. Which was problematic on a number of levels. And I wanted to be a SeaWorld trainer, which also became problematic later in life when I watched Blackfish.
Horrible. Horrible, yeah.
Really depressing. But those are the things I wanted to do. And then as many children, things evolved. And I thought at one point, oh, I want to be like Indiana Jones and be an archaeologist. And then I realized that meant science, as did SeaWorld training.
Yeah.
And I didn't love biology or things that archaeology entails, like sitting in the sun, dusting things off all day.
Yeah.
So things changed.
So always dreaming, though, as a kid, it sounds like.
Yeah. Which, funnily, I've never actually thought of it that way. I just think, like, again, I'm a kid. I was thinking about things, imagining.
Yeah.
I assume most kids did that, but yeah, I guess we could call that dreaming.
Well, I think when some kids have things at their disposal all the time, like, hey, I'm going to go play basketball or go to my next door neighbor's house, right?
Totally.
You're kind of already predictated of what you have to do. In yours, it was like the world was your oyster in a lot of ways.
Totally.
All right. So you're going around, getting involved in different stuff, dreaming. Thank God you didn't get into the SeaWorld situation.
Oh, man, I'm so glad. I could have been in that documentary.
Could have been bad. But as a child, you know, like, were you good in school? You had a lot of friends, it sounds like. Was there a particular subject matter in school that really resonated with you?
Yeah, I was really good at school because all I knew was that if I performed well, that people would pat me on the back, and that felt really good.
Okay.
And it did come naturally to me, but I certainly developed a work ethic very early. And it was interesting because when you're a twin, you see this other person walking side by side at the same stages, and you have this really clear comparison point. So I watched my twin brother excel at certain things and me excel at others. So he was exceptional at math, like genius level, would sit out in the hall and do 4 and 5 grades ahead of us when I was like struggling to do the basics. Whereas I was really great at language and I was really great at creativity. I was great at art. I was writing chapter books when I was in kindergarten and first grade.
Wow.
And he was like, how do I pronounce because? And also, I was really great with people. I was naturally someone who accumulated friends and brought people together and was always naturally popular, not because I understood that term, but, you know, I was a people person and he was the opposite. He strayed from people. He'd make a couple friends and those would be it and they'd hang out together. And so I always had this way of seeing this is what he's good at, this is what I'm good at. And often in ways we'd complement each other, where I remember very vividly we'd have those elementary school fundraisers where you'd have to go around and sell wrapping paper.
Yeah, I remember those.
And my parents started getting upset because they realized he was too shy to go door to door and do it. So I would go door to door with him, and we lived in a place that was like fairly rural. So there'd be these long driveways, and he'd stand at the end of the long driveway. I would take his sales sheet, walk to the front door, sell something for him, come back, switch, take my sales sheet, go to the next door while he waited at the end of the driveway. And it was interesting because, again, as a kid, you don't have the language or the context to understand what that means. But it's this interesting framework for where we are now that we've been business partners for 10 years, where he's the ops guy and I'm the biz dev person. And it's this perfect complementary thing that we actually developed as kids, but had no idea what we were doing.
It's interesting that you have such a complementary relationship with him. I mean, I don't meet a lot of twins. And just coincidentally, I had another person on the podcast, you know, Chris Tuff, who also has a twin.
Yep.
And the experiences from how they're being explained are completely different night and day.
Yeah.
But it's what a cool asset to have somebody that kind of can hold the weight in the area that you're not saying you're not strong, but you're probably not as passionate about.
Totally.
And then kind of in business, I mean, most people, siblings, period, cannot go into business with each other, let alone twins, I feel like. So that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. We've had our struggles, but I think in every business endeavor I've taken on, there's been challenges with people, whether they're on your team or your partner. And I've always felt like there's no one you know better than the person you shared a womb with. I always joke and say, if you can share a womb, you can share a business.
That's a great point. It's a very close proximity.
Put that on a t-shirt.
Just make sure
you there's like a really small subset of entrepreneur twin business partners who want to wear that t-shirt.
Here's another podcast idea for you. Twinning, where you just literally interview twins that are in business together. I'd be curious how many are in business together.
That's a great question. I feel like we need to get Charlie Sheen to like give over the winning thing and we'll add the T to it.
There you go.
Maybe he'll do our intro.
I like that. Yeah. I like that tiger blood.
A whole new thing has been born here.
So you're growing up in this childhood, outdoor, this rural area, and then eventually you move, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And where do you move to?
Baltimore, but the county, which very different than
very
the
different.
City.
So how'd you end up moving to Baltimore County? What brought you there? Was it your dad's work again?
Yep, okay. Exactly. He was always the reason we would move somewhere.
Okay. And at this point, when you move, you're, if my due diligence does me right, it was like 11.
Damn. Yeah.
Look at this. I didn't pass the SAT and I like failed out of school, but I do my research. LinkedIn is unbelievable.
It is, in fact.
So you end up moving to Baltimore County. And then how's your experience when you go over there?
It was an adjustment. I moved in fifth grade, and fifth grade where I lived is the top of elementary school. It's the thing I had always wanted to be, the school safety and all these leadership roles. And then suddenly you're hoisted out of one place and thrown into another. And it was like it was suburban, but it felt so much more urban and big than what I was used to. So there was an adjustment there. I came in on Halloween, which
it's quite a time
also
to come in.
Is sort of weird. Like the year is like in full swing. People are in costumes. Like there's all of this. And actually, they enrolled me in the wrong school the first day. So I went to the wrong school for a day and then went to the right school.
Wow. Okay.
But the other piece is you have this twin. So even though we weren't tight socially, at least I had someone I knew who was kind of in the same boat.
Yeah.
And then I quickly adjusted and everything was great.
So then you eventually made it to the right school.
I did.
And when you got to the right school, you know, at your previous school, like you said, you were popular. You did well with people. Did that translate and kind of carry over to this new school?
Yeah, it feels so weird to say this about oneself, but yes, it did. I remained popular.
There's nothing wrong with that. You're a people person.
I am. Whereas my brother remained the same person who made five friends who are his same five friends today.
Wow.
Yeah.
So when you get to school now, you're starting to see a different world, more urban, more activity. Are your interests changing at this point because now you're seeing things differently and new things are being presented to you?
I think they began to evolve. Like I had always loved things like dance and cheerleading and gymnastics. And I kept trying those things. I got really into instruments and kept exploring a whole variety of stuff. And then shortly after that, interestingly, my parents shipped me off to summer camp. To sleepaway camp, and they said, you know, you've been going to day camp your whole lives, you know, hashtag Jews. We were talking about that before we got on air. And they're basically like, you don't have any interests. They're like, you try things, you leave them, you try things, you leave them, which, hey, isn't that like pivoting and iterating and failing forward, as we say now? I guess I was like ahead of the curve. But they threw me into this sleepaway camp, which when you're fifth grade going to sixth grade is kind of terrifying. Yeah. They're like, we're going to send you off to the Berkshires in Massachusetts. You're going to go to the sleepaway camp for 8 whole weeks by yourself.
Wow.
And I was kind of peeing my pants. It was pretty scary, but I was trying to act all cool and hip and like I could make it happen. So I went, and it was actually there that I started to come face to face with things that I really picked up and did for a long time. The most pressing of which, or the thing that I really held on to the tightest, was black and white film photography.
Okay.
And that was something that really helped shape my interest for a long, long time.
Really? What was it about black and white photography?
It was a lot of things. One, I just loved the actual darkroom process and the creation of something. But more than that, I think it was the intangible thing that I would see something out in the wild, so to speak, and that I would visualize the image, and then I could see that come to fruition through the work of the snapping of the photo, the manipulating of the aperture and all the lighting, and then going in and making sure you didn't screw up the process of developing the film, and then actually seeing it come to fruition in your printing process. But it actually also made me more present. And at the time, I didn't understand that. But now I absolutely get it, that when you look at the world through the lens of a camera, it forces you to hone in and get really focused on details. And in black and white, for me, it really helped me see down to the shadows. So it made me focus so deeply and appreciate tiny things that I wouldn't have noticed before. And then as I evolved in it and did it through high school and college, I really started to expand to this place of utter creativity where I thought, how do I take the subject that I like most, which is people, both specifically here and in general, and do something that really makes my imagination run more freely? So I would take people and this sort of fashion photography influence that I always loved, and I would put them in outfits and environments that completely contradicted each other. So for example, like I went to Emory, and there's this place, actually people might know it from Stranger Things, it's where the whole asylum is, where all the like crazy creatures are. That is on this campus called the Briarcliff campus, where the old Woodruff and Candler mansion is based. That was just gifted to Emory, but just sat there dilapidated, probably with asbestos. And it had this beautiful greenhouse. And I remember bringing a friend of mine and having her dress in a cocktail gown and took her to this greenhouse that was overgrown with weeds, had broken glass everywhere, and we did a photo shoot in there. And it's one of my favorites of all time, where I took a friend with like messy bedhead into a field wrapped in a flag. And I was like, these things are so random, but they really helped me explore and use my creativity and exercise all these different muscles.
Do you also think this is when you first started tapping into the psyche of people?
It's a great question. I think I've always been really curious since as far back as I can remember, which allowed me to tap into the psyche of people because I was always asking questions and I was always listening. But it definitely helped me manipulate it in a certain way that I got to play around. And then also the reactions and the response you get from people viewing your art when it's weird like that is interesting as well. So I think you're hitting that on the head.
So that was your first time that you definitely were having like an impactful moment in your life, right? Like you've done other things, but this was kind of like your aha.
Yeah, it was the first time I was like, I really love this and I can see myself doing this and actually not just being like decent at it, but I could see myself having a career in this, or I could see myself just really holding on to this.
So the camp ended up being one of the greatest things ever for you.
Yeah, it's so funny. I still don't even think of it that way necessarily. It was a great experience, but you're right. It really was this turning point.
So now you're getting into photography. You're doing other things. I know at this time, too, you start taking an interest in finance, money management to some regards without even knowing that it's going to impact you later in life. So you're going through all this. Your family is teaching you different things. Photography is becoming present, kind of becoming a big part of what you're doing. Where do you go when you get back from summer camp now? Kind of are you now, I'm going to become a professional photographer? Have we thrown away the other dreams that you've kind of presented? Like, where do you mentally take it?
Well, it's interesting because when I got back from that first summer, I was maybe a week or two before school started, and my parents dropped a bomb on me that they changed my school without telling me because I had kind of become a bad kid. I went to this performing arts magnet school for 6th and 7th grade, and they said to me, well, we kind of felt like you were going down the wrong path. Like that school never actually got funded. Things weren't happening the way that they were supposed to. I really did get kind of into a bad crowd. I had girls who were in physical fights and losing their virginity when they were 13, and we're smoking cigarettes behind the school. And like, we're just like not going down a great path. And obviously now I can look back on that and be like, yeah, I'm really glad that they took me out of there, even though I enjoyed that experience tremendously. But that really became tumultuous. You're an early teenager. Yeah. You're going into 8th grade, and suddenly they want to shove me into a school that was the school I was supposed to go in from, you know, the county perspective. And my twin was there, and I knew people because I knew them from 5th grade. But that's kind of overwhelming. It's like 5th grade all over. You go at the pinnacle moment for someone's experience of middle school, and you're thrown back in, and it was not at your will. So I had to then kind of readjust, and it changed a lot for me. It even changed like my physical style, what I wore changed in each of these manifestations as well, which was also really interesting. And fashion for me has also been sort of this common thread that has gone through, and actually was the first thing I did in my career when I graduated from college, was worked in that industry. But I remember going from being what we called a yo, belovedly, back then, where, you know, I wore men's Fila and Nautica and Tommy Hilfiger polos.
Very South Florida, by the way.
Yeah.
Very South
Florida. But with like baggy jeans and like men's sneakers and my hair slicked back and dark makeup. I mean, it was special. And then I went to this eighth grade spot and I was like, yeah, that's not going to really work. And I learned how to adapt to my environment in a way that still felt authentic to me. And I became a lot more trendy or preppy or whatever. And it was interesting to look back, because when you look at photos through my childhood, they are really demarcated by my fashions.
I think we all made fashion decisions and choices. I mean, if I look back at what I did, I was out of control. I mean, it was ridiculous. I think at one point, like, I had cornrows. At one point, I had my hair was huge. I mean, I was all over the place. But I did have the Tommy stuff and the Nautica stuff and the polo stuff. But it's kind of like growing up in South Florida, that's what you did.
That's funny. Well, you know what's funny, and you're making me think of this now, is I think one of my first entrepreneurial endeavors was selling those clothes to my twin brother when I stopped wearing them.
Smart.
Because they were more his size, they were made for men, and he was wearing them anyway. So I was like, I'll make you a deal, and sold him the whole lot.
So you know what I find interesting? So you talk about having to change your look, having to do all these things, not wanting to do these things. Do you feel like some of these choices that were being made for you and then you having to pivot, like you said, is the reason why you're so big about kind of choosing your own lifestyle?
It's a really interesting point, and actually causes some self-reflection in this moment. You're probably right, but I think like anything, there's an interesting dichotomy here of choice and of uncertainty. And I think as humans, we want to be, or at least I'll speak for myself, I have historically always wanted to control as much as I can, probably to a default. And the more I have learned about myself and the older I have gotten, the more I have taken solace in accepting uncertainty and understanding that when I think I'm in control of something, it's really not true. And it's just this false story or narrative that I'm telling myself so I can feel good. And back then, I think they were just shoved in my face because, you know, you're young, you're under the control of your parents, which is a good thing. But at the time, I was this like hormonal teenager who wasn't into it, or even younger than that. And you're very reactive and emotionally energized. But yeah, now I think it's this interesting polarity of how do you be intentional and set that intention, but then release it, which is very Buddhist. But it's, you can have the intention, you can set your sights on something, but then know that as long as you're moving in the direction of it, that's your part of the control. And then it's your part of the control to go inward and figure out where is the current, the wind, the universe, however you want to call it, taking me and moving me. And how do I move within that so I'm not swimming upstream and against the current and causing strain?
Yeah.
But there's, it's an interesting balance of control and uncertainty. So yeah, I definitely have had a lot of circumstances in my life, like losing job after job after job when I graduated, that made me feel really uncertain and unstable, that made me want to take the reins into my own hands. But I now know enough to know that there's only so much I can actually control.
So then you go through this process, a lot of fashion choices that you look back on, some winners, some not so much. And you kind of have to reinvent yourself in some sense. Where do you kind of go from there? At this point, are you looking at colleges? Are you picking up new hobbies? Kind of what's your mindset?
Yeah, I mean, I think like a lot of suburban kids, I get to high school, I'm checking all the boxes. I'm cheerleading captain, youngest ever. I'm on student government. I'm in all of the AP classes. I'm at all the parties and keeping my social life alive. I'm doing all of these different things. And I'm getting straight A's. And so I'm thinking, all right, I'm killing the game, crushing this. So everything is about the next and the future. And back then I had absolutely no concept of how to look inward and figure out what I really wanted, or how to de-stress, or how to not live in the past or the future and be present, which are skills that I'm constantly trying to hone in on. So at that point it was really, okay, well, the success that's been defined for me and modeled for me is go to the best school with the best reputation that you can, figure out what you want to major in so you can make a good amount of money and live in the pretty house and have the picket fence and la-di-da, happily ever after. So that was where I was setting my sights.
Okay. So you're looking at the American dream, as many would say.
Yes.
And is this because society says it, or because this is what you want?
This is what my parents wanted for me.
Got it. How many times do you think that people affect the outcome of their lives or decisions based on the opinions of the parents?
Most of the time.
And do you feel like that's something that parents should be more embracing of, following what their kids are going after? You know, you always hear, and you said something early on, you're like, I knew at a very early age, like, photography was my thing. I always wish that I knew, like, my thing was this, right, growing up. And I always say, having a kid now, if my daughter says something or wants something, I'm going to put all my energy into it if she's passionate about it. Mm-hmm. Because I feel like a lot of times people go into things for others and not for themselves. And it's hard as a kid, right, respectfully, to be like to your parent, you know, screw you, I'm going to go do this.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. I'm not a parent, so I can only speak from the perspective of being a child and of watching people parent and seeing what seems successful. And I don't think that there's an equation. I don't think there's a perfect way to do anything, let alone parent, which seems like the hardest thing to do. But I do think it's important to take cues from your kids. I think it's important to have some humility to say, I am the parent and I have some guardrails and some boundaries here so that they can't go too far off course. But then to listen to your kid and take those cues and see what they're gravitating towards. So I was lucky to have parents who had the means and the foresight to say, let's throw you into this camp that you don't want to go to. Because actually my mom went there and it was really inspiring for her. And she thought, listen, I want you to be passionate about something. And this is a whole other sidebar. But even in high school, I had a religious conversion experience that was very, very challenging for my family to digest. But my mom's verbatim response was, well, I want you to believe in something as long as you believe in something. And I think that sort of goes back to this point that if a parent can allow their kids to, within reason, get excited about something that's not harming to anyone and allows them, like you said, to get passionate, then that's great. But the other interesting piece that you brought up is that you always wanted to have this thing that you knew was your thing. I still, even looking back, don't think that I had that thing. Even though I thought it was photography, I hit a point pretty early on in my young adult life where I had done enough apprenticeships and internships with different aspects of the photography world to realize I did not want to do it professionally and it would ruin my love for it. And it was meant to be a hobby, which then put me in a tailspin all over again because I thought I have no effing clue what I want to do with my life. And then I'm in a university, I went to Emory, where the bulk of my friends, at least so they said, knew what they wanted to do. Most people were going into traditional business and consulting at that time, law and being doctors. And I'm sitting there being like, I like fashion. I can take some pictures. I don't know anyone who's doing these professionally and I don't want to do the photography thing as a career. What the hell am I going to do? And it was very, very hard for me to grapple with that. And that's why I have a real soft spot for people who are at any point in their lives who are looking for some direction.
So you end up going to Emory, like you said. Was there a reason why you selected Emory?
Yeah, it was twofold. One, I didn't like anywhere.
Okay. And well, that's a good answer.
And the one that I liked at the time, the first school I ever visited was University of Virginia. And when you're a kid growing up in Maryland, that seems far enough, but not too far. And if anyone has been there, you can agree with me that it is one of the most beautiful campuses. But I will say I had the foresight to know I wanted a really diverse campus. And sorry, UVA, but at least in the 2001, 2002 time that I was looking, you were not diverse. I don't think that you're that much more diverse now, given recent-ish things going on in Charlottesville. And so that was a real big turnoff for me. But that also being said, I also didn't get in. Graduating from a school in Maryland, a lot of people trying to go out of state and go to University of Virginia. So I didn't get in. And then I'm looking at all these schools I applied to. I think I applied to 12. And after I did all my applications thinking I'm going to dual major in business and photography, my parents drop a bomb on me and they say, we're not going to send you to a state school. You didn't even apply to Maryland. So we're not sending you out of state to another state school. And I had applied to Tennessee. I'd applied to UNC. I'd applied to Virginia. I'd applied to all these state schools. And I'm thinking, well, that would have been really helpful to know before. So suddenly I'm in a position where I had been waitlisted at BC where my older brother went, and I was really eager to go there only because he had gone to boarding school from the time I was in second grade until forever. So he was a distant cousin to me for all intents and purposes. So I basically wanted to go spend time with my brother. But I was waitlisted, and I thought, well, shit, I might not have anywhere to go if this doesn't work out. And I'd gotten into Emory. And the only reason I had applied to Emory is because my aunt went there for undergrad and law school. She had a great experience, and she just said, consider it. I knew nothing about Atlanta. I knew very little about Emory. And spring break, my senior year of high school, my mom and I fly down and we check it out. And I remember asking the tour guide something along the lines of, like, I heard this kind of like a nerd school. It's a popular girl in me. And can you tell me about it? And I ended up falling in love with it. It was one of those perfect Atlanta days where it's 75 and sunny and everyone's outside and they all seem so happy, and they had a photography program and a great business program. And I thought, okay, I can make this the place that I fall in love with. And I think actually that set a precedent for me of recognizing that you don't have to be passionate about something to make the decision, but you can make a decision and then become passionate about it. And that has served me really well in my professional career, which has helped me do really unsexy things like start credit card processing companies.
Yeah. I think that's a great point. I mean, I think a lot of people are waiting for like that silver bullet, that perfect moment, their dream, and then they're wasting so much time
totally
that they're not executing. So it's interesting that you had that foresight. So you end up going to Emory. Sounds like you end up loving it.
I still sit on the board. I loved Emory.
Which is an amazing thing. And I mean, that school has produced amazing kids that have come out of it, amazing talent that's come out of it. You studied at Emory, if I remember this correctly, religion and Italian.
Batting perfect score over here.
Thank you. Thank you. It doesn't happen often.
I'm like, what is that, 300?
Something like that. So at this point, what made you go into those majors? Because this is completely left field of what you had proposed earlier.
Yeah. I came into school thinking I was going to study, as I said, photography and business. Got there and realized Emory had lied to me. And there wasn't actually a photography major.
Really?
Yeah. They had classes, but there was no major. So I was like, well, shit. And I couldn't even enroll in them until my sophomore year at minimum. And then it was like really competitive, because the darkroom fit 8 people. So I was like, well, I'm going to take those classes, but I better figure out something. And then I realized at Emory, to go to the business school, you have to apply in your sophomore year, and then you end up graduating just from the business school and not from the university.
Oh, wow.
And I realized, well, actually, this is what I did. I did an experiment. I called my dad, who had been in corporate America his whole career, and I said, can you introduce me to some of your friends in corporate America? I want to ask them a question. And he said, okay. So I talked to a handful of his friends and I said, would you rather hire someone with a marketing degree to work in your company or someone with a liberal arts degree? And they said, unless it's a really specialized field like accounting or something like that, we'd rather the liberal arts degree because it teaches us that you've learned how to be creative and flexible and that you learn to learn and that you can really think a little bit more uniquely. And they said, you don't necessarily need to study marketing if that's what you want to go into. And I thought, perfect, because I didn't really want to go into it anyway. It just seemed like the thing I would most like at business school. So I decided to then do a lot of searching within liberal arts and figure out what I liked. And the reason I gravitated towards Italian was I had studied French growing up, and I felt like fashion was the only direction I really had at that time. So it was my best way of convincing my parents that they were getting the most out of my education with my random ass study pattern. So I said, if I speak the 3 fashion languages, Italian, French, and English, I'll go into the fashion industry. They totally bought it, hook, line, and sinker. Worked out great. Got to study in Italy. Love the Italian language, culture, people, food. Nothing to not love about it.
Yeah, it's the best.
And that was a great choice. And then religion, I mentioned the religious conversion. That really sparked for me in high school this interest in understanding world religions and cultures and people in a deeper way. And as I got into it, the more I realized when you understand what makes someone tick from the perspective of religion, whether it's a titled religion or atheism or agnosticism, you can much better understand their decision making and their values. And then fascinatingly, most people in my program were pre-med because they wanted to understand their patients. And it really gave me this global view that helped me catapult this deep, deep, deep curiosity into people and what makes them tick.
I mean, first, I want to step back. I find it super impressive that you had the business acumen, in a sense, to call your dad's friends and ask them what they thought of this. I mean, such a smart idea, but yet such a simple idea that most people would never even take the step to do.
Thank you.
And I think, you know, the biggest thing is people look at business degrees and all this, and half the people I know that came out of college with a business degree, you ask them, well, what do you do? And they're like, nothing in that space. I just thought business was cool as shit.
Yeah.
And I want to be an entrepreneur, which everybody wants to be.
Yep.
Which is not as exciting as people think.
Nope.
A lot of work, a lot of balance required. So to ask that question, though, is pretty, pretty smart because it doesn't cost money. It doesn't cost anything except a friendly phone call. And it saved you what could have been a 4-year waste in something that would have been a miserable selection.
Totally. And there could have been some selection bias. Who knows? I could have talked to 10 other people and they could have given me a different answer. But who cares? It worked out.
Yeah. And then on the religion front, it's super interesting because it's almost like you think about people in business, especially sales, psychology is such a huge part of it. But then you take it to that level and it really shows you a person and what their kind of makes them tick, like you said, and what resonates with them. So just a very interesting perspective on what you did.
Thank you. You didn't ask me the question that most people ask, which was, did you want to be the first female pope? To which my answer is typically, that would be surprising, not only being Jewish.
Correct.
But being a woman.
Correct. Never did that thought cross my mind to ask that question. Maybe I'm not as skilled in this position because this is not what I do. Or I'm not that intelligent, one of the two, but...
I was going to go with option C, which was you just are a little more common in your thinking and more natural, and it's not that normal to think that that's
what I'm just more surprised that is like a common question that you've been asked.
You know what the second most common question is are my twin brother and I identical?
Wow. Life-changing stuff.
You want to know my answer to that?
Sure.
One of us is really unfortunate looking, if that's true.
It's another good answer. I can't contest these answers, but I'm sure you've had a lot of practice to answer these.
Yeah, exactly. You really hone in on those punchlines.
Wow. All right. So now you study at Emory. You do well in school, it sounds like.
Yes.
And then you're getting ready to graduate and you say, okay, now I could speak Italian, which is wonderful.
Yeah. CC.
And Italian and Spanish, a lot of similarities in a lot of ways. And then you know about world religion. What do you do with that?
I had no idea. I actually felt tremendously overwhelmed with that decision and that turning point where, you know, you've spent 4 years in this very prestigious to some people's standards institution, and I'm watching all my friends setting up themselves for graduation, and they're getting six-figure jobs, or they're taking all of their LSATs and MCATs, and they're getting ready to go to all these prestigious graduate programs. And I'm thinking, I have absolutely no idea what I want to do. And I remember going to the Career Services Center. Sorry, Emory, I'm about to hand you a shit hand here. And them saying, no one has ever asked us about doing anything that non-traditional, certainly not in fashion. And they said, we have one alumni who we can think of who went into that space, and it's Kenneth Cole.
Small name.
Right. Yeah. And I was like, okay. And they said, well, have you considered talking to him? I said, I actually met him at a fraternity party once because he has this fellowship at Emory. He was very nice, and it was a great conversation, but I was like, but that's not, like, that doesn't help me figure out what I want to do with my life. And they basically said, well, we don't know what to tell you. Have you Googled it? And I was like, wow.
Wow. This is well worth the money, Emory.
Really, really poor career consulting. So I left there feeling ever more confused and feeling a lot of pressure, thinking my parents have always told me that they're going to support me through college, but once college ends, I'm on my own. And I had this true ever-present fear that I was going to be homeless. And I say that with absolutely no jest. Like, I truly felt like I was going to graduate, my parents were going to cut me off, I was going to have absolutely no future, and I had no idea what to do about it. So honestly, I just remember feeling really stuck. And ultimately, I had gotten a part-time job over the summers when I was at Emory working in this fashion store in downtown Decatur, which is right near Emory, and became really close with the owners. And I call them my Jamaican parents. And she, the owner, Camille, she would often take me on her buying trips. And she would have me help her organize and do all these other things and really round out the places that she wasn't as naturally gifted in. And I remember really enjoying it and really loving that whole experience because I was in the fashion industry and I was getting to see behind the curtain. And then out of nowhere, she came to me one day and she said, do you remember this guy, Randy? He works in that one showroom where they sell high-end jeans that we buy. And she said, he asked about you and he was curious if you have a job lined up. And I was like, I definitely don't have a job lined up. And so ended up connecting with Randy and getting my first job working for this fashion brand out of LA through his showroom in Atlanta and getting this springboard to start my career. And feeling really lucky that I had set off on this path that I didn't even know I was setting off on just by taking this part-time job and befriending this woman, which really I think is the underpinning current of my entire career, where I didn't always know exactly where it was going to lead, but I stayed open. I listened for cues. I always did my best wherever I was so that I was putting my best foot forward. And it just seems warranted. Someone's paying you to do something. And then, you know, lastly, developing the relationships and being a person who wasn't looking for something in exchange for them, but just truly adding value because I felt like that was the right thing to do.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting. I speak to a lot of people, especially on this podcast, and the ones that did a great job, whether it be an internship, whether it be working part-time at a clothing store, and did it to the best of their abilities, always ended up getting an opportunity because somebody was always watching or paying attention. And I feel like so many times people do a shit job at things because like, this is temp, or I'm not going to put, this isn't my
dream.
They think
it's beneath them.
But they don't realize you never know how full circle this stuff comes.
Well, it's full circle. It's a perfect point. So when, right before I wrapped up college, I took an internship in PR because I thought maybe I'd be into that. And it was with this woman, Liz, and I did an 8-week stint with her. And I remember hating the PR world. I felt like it was smoke and mirrors, and it was like everything I'm not into. And Liz and I had a fine relationship, but then we never saw each other again. Then out of nowhere, gosh, how many years had gone by? Maybe 10 or 12 years had passed. I met a man named Jeff, and he starts talking to me, and then he mentions his wife, who at the time they weren't married, was Liz. Now, Liz, Jeff, and I are all very close. We hang out all the time. And Liz, I'd consider a peer, as although she was a former boss. And it was so fascinating because of that exact point that I could have been there and been like, ah, it's just an internship. It's only 8 weeks. I'm just going to like put in the minimum. But I didn't. And she remembered that. And now we're friends and peers, and we help each other in the business world and in life. And that never would have happened. She would have thought I was some asshole who was, you know, super millennial and couldn't just do the job well. If it weren't for that, and while that didn't turn into an opportunity per se, it does in small ways. Like with my networking events company, she lines me up with venues and sponsors and liquor brands and things like that because of our relationship.
So you meet Liz, that comes back full circle. You then get this opportunity to sell a jean brand, and now you're technically going into sales.
Mm-hmm.
So now you have experience selling in store and going on buying trips. You have your studies of Italian, religion. Now this is your first go around truly at sales.
Yes.
And how does that experience go for you?
It was exceptional. And actually the place I learned that I knew how to sell aside from that selling stuff as a kid with my brother was being my sorority recruitment chair.
Okay.
I remember we'd have maybe 1,000 or so women go through this recruitment process and me thinking to myself, wow, I'm basically selling them on why they should join our sorority so that they want us and we can choose who we want. And we would have 99% retention after every round and 100 at some of them. And I was like, wow, I'm actually like really good at this. And so when it got to that point, I was like, okay, I can do this. I believe in the product. I know how to build rapport with people. And they gave me $1 million sales target to do within my first 3 years. And I did it in 10 months.
So you did $1 million in 10 months, what yes. was supposed to be done in three years. Why do you think you were so successful?
For those basic reasons, I think I know how to build rapport. I know how to listen. So when someone tells me like, this is what I truly need, that I'm listening and I can provide them with what works. And I'm willing to lose a sale to do the right thing. So I would go into a boutique and they would say, you know, like I haven't been selling through this. And I'd be like, you know what? You don't need any more of this. And here's what I think we should do to make sure you sell through this product. And that really builds a reputation and a brand for yourself that is invaluable and never goes away. And so they would refer me to someone else or they would come back when things got better. And that stuff really, really pays off.
I definitely think the listening aspect you mentioned is huge, right? And I think this doesn't matter if it's business, relationships. We listen and then there's really listening. You know, a lot of times people talk and it's always like, what am I going to say next without really hearing what you're saying to me? Yep. But so many people, if they just took the time to actually hear people, you would be able to really understand what their pain points were.
Yes.
I'm sure studying religions probably gave a lot of insight to that because you have to be open-minded. Like you said, you have to process this stuff. So you hit $1 million in 10 months, which was a 3-year goal. Your boss must love you at this point. What do you do at this point now?
Well, so at that point, it started to go downhill because of a number of factors, mostly out of my control in the sense of this was 2006-07 era. So the economy starts to tank and I'm selling $250 pairs of jeans. So that bubble is bursting. So that's challenging. Secondly, the company, the manufacturer that I'm working for, they're having a lot of internal problems. They're not fulfilling products. Things aren't getting out on time. They're having a lot of issues that me as the face, I'm having to take the brunt of, which is injuring my relationships. And then also when you work in that space, there's exclusivity. So if I work with a boutique, you know, we're in Atlanta in the Virginia Highlands, I can work with one. I can't work with any others. So you also have, I've saturated the market at this point. So at that point, I started to realize I'm not learning anything anymore. I'm not growing. I'm starting to see all of the deficiencies that are not really lining up with my personality, like being in 2-star hotels on the road week after week, having to bail on plans that I'd committed to, like at that time, my kickball league or whatever else I was doing, and feeling like that was out of character for me. And so I started to get to this point where I was like, I don't really feel like I can grow here anymore. And on top of it, it was pretty catty. I didn't work directly with anyone because I was working remotely. But when we'd be at trade shows or in sales meetings, people were pretty rude and pretty harsh and really wanted to cut each other down. It started to give me a taste for what it was like to be in a place where people didn't support each other and where people were really driven by a scarcity mindset rather than an abundance one. And so quickly I started to think, okay, I'm only a year and a half into this. I want to get out. But I learned from that that when you're comfortable, it's really hard to push yourself out of the nest voluntarily. So while I was quote unquote looking, I was just stagnant. And, you know, at the time I thought it was a horrible thing, but I ended up losing that job about a week before Christmas of 2007, I believe, because the company went under. And I had bought a house 3 months before that because I was in duress with a restraining order against my former landlord, and I didn't want to have a landlord again. And so at this point, I'm 23 years old with a mortgage, no job, eating a lot of shit, realizing, oh, this is grown-up life. Like, this is what I'm dealing with now. And I don't have the opportunity to be really lax about this anymore. I need to figure out what my next step is.
So when you ended up losing the job, it sounds like comfort is, especially at 23, you're making good money. It sounds like if you're buying homes, you're getting all these things. And a lot of times we just, you know, make excuses or say, another month, and then it turns into 2 years and shit's boring. So you get pushed out, which sounds like a blessing in disguise, right? Yes. Now you really have to figure it out because you have to adult, as you said.
Exactly.
So, you know, during that time, are you down? Is it fuel to fire? Like, how does that impact you? How does that motivate you, unmotivate you?
I was really scared. I mean, for me, I take commitments really seriously, like to the nth degree. Like if I told you I'm going to be here at 3 o'clock and I'm not here at 3 o'clock, I'm beating myself up.
You were here at 3 o'clock.
I was here exactly at 3 o'clock. And so, but like even little things, so let alone signing legal papers, like you probably have signed them. When you sign off on a mortgage, it's like 200 pages of signing away what feels like all of your financial freedom. And when I thought like, holy shit, am I going to foreclose on this house? Like, I didn't want to turn to my parents. I didn't want to move to Baltimore and move home. I was like, I'm just getting started. What am I going to do? So at first it was truly fear and it was sort of paralyzing. But then, yeah, it did light a fire under me to say, you have to figure something out because you wallowing this is doing you no favors. So I did a lot of different things for a couple years that looking back felt like experiments. At the time, just felt like survival.
So what were some of these things?
One was becoming a personal assistant to a woman who was sort of a Jill of all trades, and it enabled me to learn a lot. She at one point had a show on CNN, and she was this like online thought leader, like kind of well before her time. So I was writing copy for her websites and promoting her books. And she was a real estate investor, which was something I was really interested in. So I was literally ripping carpets and drywall out of houses and tiling floors with her and learning the model and the numbers and just doing all these odd jobs with her. So did that. I worked retail again. I worked in inside sales at a fashion showroom where I would do cold calls and other things. And I truly just took many things on. And then a lot of those, I got laid off again or my hours got cut back because, again, we're in like the thick of the recession at this point. And I started getting really frustrated because I truly, and I know this with certainty, was giving my all. I put my blood, sweat, tears, heart, soul into all of these endeavors. And I knew that I was being of value to them. However, when companies are going under, it doesn't matter. So this keeps happening over and over. I end up taking a full-time job at a high-end home audio video company, which was like the last thing I ever would have expected, doing sales for them, selling home theaters and automation systems and all of that jazz. And within, gosh, maybe 9 months, they quote-unquote laid me off, but I think they fired me. And it was really a fascinating culture to learn about where the owner of the company the co-founder, he reached out to me after I was let go and he said, you know, I saw what happened and I want to be transparent with you that the owner was going to the board and lying because he, and this was his words, he can't handle strong females. He told them that the clients didn't like you and that they should let you go. And he's like, I knew that wasn't true. I saw you with our clients. I heard their feedback, but I knew this was an unhealthy environment for you. I would drive home crying every day from that job, but I felt like this was me paying the dues and I had to do it. And he's like, so I let it go about that way. And obviously there's a lot of issues that I could raise with that. But again, like there was a silver lining and it was this blessing in disguise. And looking back, I'm really grateful because when I had this stream of disappointments and this stream of layoffs and cutbacks, I began to realize that the tale I had been told of go to school, get a good job, get the job, you know, the job will pay for this, la-di-da, happily ever after, it's so stable to work for other people, wasn't true for me. And that even though I had known intrinsically since I was very young that I wanted to have my own business, I was also taking in the tale of you're a millennial and you're entitled and you can't wait your turn, be more patient. And I was letting those things dictate my future. And then when I realized me putting my fate in other people's hands and then taking it away from me like that was not working, I thought, what do I have to lose to take it into my own hands and strive for this thing that I have always known in my heart I have wanted? So that was the turning point.
I mean, I think it's really interesting because I feel like the universe was telling you time and time and time again, like, get out of this. This is not for you. That, like, we don't want you doing this.
Yeah, exactly.
And but to most people, they look at exactly how you said is like, am I failing? Am I not succeeding? Am I being too millennial? But eventually it hits you in the head where you're like, all right, something is up here because I'm performing, I'm delivering. This is just happening too frequently. So then you finally say, okay, it's a feeling that you've kind of manifested early on, didn't know what to do with it. Now you have it, and where do you go from here now that this kind of happened?
So it's one thing to know you want to start a business, and it's another to know what the business
correct.
Is.
That's always a hard thing, yeah.
That's a really hard thing, because if you're about to put your all into something, you want to really believe in it, and that doesn't always happen overnight. It often takes a really long time to back into that. So I was fortunate that here comes my twin again. He popped his head up where he was living in San Diego at the time, and he said, listen, I'm starting this company in credit card processing. I think you'd be really complimentary here. What do you think? And my initial response was, how dare you think that I would do something so unsexy? Have you seen the work that I've been doing? I have no interest in this. But then I stopped and I thought, you know what? I have literally nothing going on. I'm going to fly to San Diego. And he had started it at this point. And I said, I'm going to shadow and see. And so I went out there for a week and devil's advocated the hell out of it. And I talked to his sales reps and his partners at the time and asked all these questions and learned a lot and went on calls with them. And I was like, you know what? There is something to this. And I'm realizing that my interest in this doesn't have to be specific to the service, but this really dovetails well with what I think I'm great at. It's about building relationships. It's about helping businesses with their bottom line. I'll get to meet all these different business owners. I'll get to learn about all these different industries. I'll get to help them in this way that's so critical to their business's operations. And I can get excited about the service because of that. So I ended up saying yes to him with the caveat that we have to do it and I don't trust your business partners and we have to go out and do this on our own. So that was messy, but we did it.
Okay.
That's where it began.
Okay, so you make the jump. What I do like that you said is that it wasn't an industry that was particularly sexy to you, right? I had spoken with a friend of mine that came on the podcast a couple weeks ago, Taylor, and he has a very successful business in IT. And he said, I didn't do it because it was the industry. It was the things within it that I was doing that I liked,
yes.
The sales, the people building. And I think so often we're kind of programmed to look at the industry first,
yes.
The skill set second. And when you really look at it backwards, it's way more effective. As what is your end goal? Is it money? Is it success?
Yes.
Is it people? And we're so kind of programmed to look at it the other way around. So you go in, you tell your brother, look, I don't trust your partners. I'm going to shake shit up and we're going to start this on our own.
Yes.
And he says, okay.
Yeah.
And then you go out on your own and you do it.
Yeah.
And then you start this. What's the feeling? Is it excitement, fear? Do you already have a track record going from other clients you guys had previously brought on? How's that process for you?
We started from scratch.
Okay.
And the nice thing was is that from the wholesale fashion world, all of my clients were retailers. So I had, I think, about 90 clients that I could go back to and see if they might be able to transition their service to ours.
Smart.
Certainly all of them didn't, but it was a really great starting point in a space that I already had relationship and trust, which I was then able to parlay outside of that to other spaces and places, which was great because I was able to sort of get my footing under me and grow some confidence, which is really important when you're starting something,
yeah.
To able to bloom from there. But I will say, I think like you talked about how entrepreneurship is often thought of as so romantic and sexy, and it's not often or always that way. Because I want to be really clear that even though we've been in this for 10 years and now we're in 38 states and we feel really successful in all the conventional terms, it was a real struggle for a long ass time, to the point where even 2-3 years in, when I had thought we'd finally gotten over that hurdle and we had the income coming in and it's a residual-based business, so you can kind of predict it and expect it to come. Some of our, like I remember particularly one whale of a client who was, I'm embarrassed to say, about 80% of our revenue pulled. and we were back to square one almost, and I was devastated. And so, you know, all those years, I felt a lot of constriction. I felt a lot of fear. I felt a lot of anxiety. And then I finally thought I was over this hurdle, and then it was gone. And then there were two other points in our first, I think, 5 years where we had embezzlement, where we had companies that we partnered with stole our entire book of business. And given the way the contracts were worded, we didn't have the capacity financially to fight them. So we lost everything those times as well. So there were three times where we basically got wiped out and then had to start all over. And I remember one of those times, the third time, my mom called and she said, I think you should stop, which is one of the hardest things to hear when you're an entrepreneur, because you're at this point, I'm already doubting myself. I'm already feeling as down as I have probably ever felt about something in this arena. And then the person who you hope believes in you the most is asking you to stop. I had to trust my own instincts and say, I know I can do this. I've seen evidence of that. I'm going to keep going, whether or not you agree with it. That was really, really hard, but I'm so grateful I did, because now we're in a place that is so much more stable.
Yeah. So instinct you talked about, right? The one thing I've learned over however many years of doing this is gut and instinct is everything.
Yes.
And predominantly, I will even say this, I am a huge believer that a woman's instinct and gut is the most powerful tool.
Yeah.
And thankfully, I'm surrounded by very strong women at our company and women who I tremendously respect. And any time that I've been questionable on something and I've gone to them and they've told me not to do it and I've done it, it's gone wrong.
Yep.
And then you eventually learn it's something that's an internal skill set you can't teach, but too many people look the other way. I mean, I think gut is everything. And the fact that you sat there and said, I'm going to keep going. I mean, that is a hell of a gut feeling to do that after three times of going through some pretty emotional roller coasters. Yeah.
It's tough, because one of the other things that I learned and experienced, and that I'm curious if you've ever felt this way, is I was tying my entire identity and success metrics to the financial outcomes of this company. And so each time it went away, not only did it seem like the company was going to zero, I felt like I went to zero.
Yeah.
That's really a shitty place to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely happened with us. I mean, you know, and I've had multiple businesses on top of this, and some have done well and some have gone to shit. And when you are kind of becoming synonymous with the brand and the brand fails, you fail.
Yeah.
And it's vice versa. Egotistically, it's a hard pill to swallow. And it's not for me. It's not others' opinions as much as it is me versus me. And then you're disappointed in yourself. And then you say, why didn't I do this differently? Did I miss that? It is a challenging thing. And I think it's people, though, that like yourself can overcome the challenges, the fear, the stress, that end up coming out on the other side winning. It's just most people are not willing to keep going through it, because yeah, it's brutal.
You basically just quoted a Lincoln quote that I'm going to ruin, but it's something along those lines of success is one step after failure, but most people stop at failure. And in which case, failure isn't even a thing. You don't fail if you keep going.
Yeah. And I don't know if it's stupidity on my part, ignorance, or if it's just, I just don't want to quit. But I think, look, at the end of the day, nothing comes easy. And I think for you to go through three times of challenges to keep on going, there was something there burning inside you that you're like, hey, this is the play. So you end up coming over that hurdle after 5 years. You're now, what, 10 years in business?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So 10 years in business back on track. Hopefully no more crazy stories.
Gosh, knock on
no
this
more
table.
Crazy situations. So now that you have this kind of up and running, right, and you're doing well with it, I'm sure your creative mind is not set just on staying with this one industry.
No, it definitely was not.
So where do you start to look out at other opportunities?
Well, interestingly, I didn't intentionally. So I talked about Network Under 40, and that happened completely by accident. And it was 2 years into Equitable Payments, the first company. And I'm so grateful for the way this transpired, because I wouldn't have thought I had the capacity if I was just dreaming it. I wouldn't have thought of the idea if I was just trying to like muscle through and start another thing. But I'm grateful for it because I paid attention to cues, and I'll explain what that was. And I'm grateful for it because it also gave me a side hustle that was kicking off income while I was going through these ebbs and flows in the early years with my first business that really allowed me to live and live some of my values while I was making a living.
So for those that don't know, you founded Network Under 40. And yes. What is that for people that may not be familiar with it?
It's a networking events company that puts on events in mid-tier U.S. cities that help young professionals have fun, make peer-based friends, basically not get hit on, sold to, or be in a room with everyone who's their parents' age. So you can first build social connection and second build business relationships.
I'll tell you, there was a line that I read that you talked about when you were talking about network under 40. And I thought it was such a smart thing. It exists at the intersection of friendship and business.
Thank you.
And I think that a lot of times in business, when you can build true relationships and true kind of rapport with individuals, the money's wonderful, but it's what you gain out of people that is just really the most impactful, and I feel like the most rewarding at the end of the day.
Yeah.
It's more than a transaction.
Yes, exactly. Relationships are always more valuable than transactions, which means long game over short game.
So here you are again, kind of influencing people, bringing people together in the right ways. You're selling, but not in the traditional sense. You're applying those tactics you learn. So the first 2 years, you're doing this as a side hustle. And when you look at most entrepreneurs, there's always buckets and side hustles and things that you're going on. And people are obviously gravitating towards this idea. How much energy are you putting in at this point to Equitable? How much are you putting into network under 40? How are you balancing it?
Yeah, in the beginning, Equitable was the primary thing. I felt like that's the thing I'm really building. I see that as a business. Whereas when I started network under 40, I was probably spending 20% of my time on it, thinking this is just something I'm doing to help my friend. And we had our first event and 94 people showed up and the energy was electric and they said, do this again. And I thought, okay, I can do this again. And so I was never thinking of it as, let me systemize this, let me make it a business, let me figure out all these things. I just kept doing it like baby step until I realized, wow, like there's a real market demand for this. I can actually encapsulate this into something. But yeah, it just became this thing that sort of organically generated.
And then how many years have you had this going on? Because it seems like, you know, you could have easily pushed it away or say, I don't have time for this, but you kind of let it kind of fester and grow into something organically, like you said.
Yeah.
And then look, I mean, it ends up turning into a pretty recognizable business. How long have you been doing it?
8 years.
8 years. Wow. And how much time now at the peak of it are you putting into this?
Well, at the peak, I was putting in like 70%. But
okay.
Now I put in about 40% or so because I've built out a team to help me.
What is the goal for entrepreneurs? This is what I'm always curious about that have multiple businesses. What is that percentage that is kind of like that sweet spot to say, if I can only put this amount of time with being effective and having the right people, it's worth me doing?
I mean, I guess it depends on what those outcomes are and what your whole like model is and what you value. Because with Equitable Payments, for me to spend about 5% of my time on it and have all of my operating expenses, all of my savings, and all of my investment comes from that income. So everything else is just like bonus.
Yeah.
That's pretty fucking phenomenal.
Yeah.
And that wasn't my goal, but I realized like, wow, I have backed myself into a business that allows me to do that. And when I stopped growing and learning in the way that I wanted, I could take the foot off the gas and invested in this other thing, which really is the true intersection of what I think I am great at in the world, which is connecting people and making that a thing that I had financial earnings around. It doesn't get better than that. However, I also realized at a certain point, there are certain tactical things that I was like, you know what, this doesn't excite me anymore. Someone else is going to enjoy this more and be better suited to do it. And I can free my time up to do something like develop the course that we were talking about, mm-hmm. where it helps other people learn to do it for themselves.
Yeah. So most people will never make it past one business. You have two now going on close to 10 years. And on top of all this, you decide, I'm going to write a book
mm-hmm.
for children about mm-hmm. financial literacy.
Yes, naturally.
I have no idea where this came from. We'll touch on this briefly because then I want to talk about kind of what I call the parent company of all these ideas of yours. But where did this kind of evolve?
When the recession really got swinging and I had been hit by it, I watched a lot of my friends struggle. And a lot of them came to me and were asking for financial advice, which I found shocking and surprising. I was making, when I was in my first jobs, like $35,000. And I didn't have a lot of debt. Fortunately, I didn't have school loans, which I'm really grateful for. And I obviously had my house at that point and I had a car loan. But beyond that, I didn't have credit card debt or other debts. And I was still able to save and like live decently well. And they were coming to me with all these struggles. And often they're making six figures. And I got really confused. And so I started to recognize, much like we talked about earlier, that most kids think that their upbringing is the way that everyone is raised. And I didn't realize until that moment that my parents had been exceptionally intentional about teaching my brothers and I financial responsibility habits. And other people's parents apparently were not doing that. So I had already done a pretty good scan of the marketplace for adult literature because I had been studying it since I was 13, 14. Like I was truly the kid sitting on the beach reading Robert Kiyosaki's books, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and whatever else, while my friends were reading Us Weekly. And I just thought that was like normal. Why not? But then as I got older, I thought, well, most people are apparently not learning this when they're children. By the time they're adults, they have these bad habits and practices that are really hard to retrain. Why are we not teaching them earlier? So I started researching. I found some studies that talked about the fact that kids learn about money as early as age 3. However, they're typically learning through bad models and behaviors. So I thought, well, what if I can intersect them when they're starting to learn these messages, kind of like the baby Einstein of financial literacy. So I think in an hour, 6 kids' books came out of my mind. And I had an image of the characters and the land that they lived in, and it all just unfolded. And that set me on a path to spend 3 years to publishing the first of the 6 books in the series. And it really just truly came from this place of, how can I help? Here is a problem. I have some of this knowledge. Where is there an intersection here that could really utilize this positively? And I just went and did it.
Do you feel that, whether it be the kid books, selling the home audio equipment, selling jeans, whatever it was, it seems like the reason you've been successful is because there was a cause and a purpose and a need to want to help people, like make people feel good, which in turn gave you certain gratitude and gave you certain affirmation.
Totally.
So you kind of have almost like a best of series going on right now in your life, where you're doing all these different kind of facets. You're teaching, you're connecting, you're entrepreneurial. You're kind of doing all these different verticals and getting the same result, right? Which is positivity results, but doing it in different ways. Then you say to yourself one day, is it just that, okay, I'm doing some pretty cool shit. People are apparently listening to me. Whatever I'm teaching or I've taught myself or learned from others is effective. I'm going to try to create a program, a brand, how do you go out? Is it like, I want to create my own brand, or did that also organically happen?
So the personal brand development started happening again by accident. I started writing for Entrepreneur Magazine and Forbes and all these different outlets because I wanted to elevate stories for people who weren't getting the spotlight, and because I wanted to exercise my writing muscle, which is something I had always loved but had kind of let fall to the wayside. And then I started realizing, oh, wow, like this is a platform that gives me credibility too, and people are recognizing that. And I was starting to get asked to speak and do these other things, and I started to think, okay, if I put some intention into that, that could really grow. But secondarily, it was going back to the instinct thing that we were talking about, that about 2 years ago, I started feeling this overwhelming urge that was telling me, Dara, there is a new incarnation of your career coming. You have to figure out what it is and do it. And that, again, is like starting off in my career. And I was like, I don't know what's going to happen. This is really confusing. But it set me off on this path to really go inward, as well as to leverage the people around me who could help reflect some things back to me that I wasn't seeing, to recognize that the number one question that people were asking me wasn't the one I thought it was for a long time, which was about building relationships. It was broader than that. It was, how do you live the life that you do? Because I want to live it too. And what I realized they meant was, they watched me travel 60% of the time for pleasure. They watched me be in rooms like the UN and Davos and TED. They watched me work with people that were super high profile. They watched me build these businesses and have all of this freedom. And it wasn't that they wanted my exact life, but they wanted something like that for themselves. And so I thought, okay, I want this part of my career to be about service to that. I want to give people the tools and resources I've been accumulating through my young adult career to offer them to them in a packaged way, which really just takes this connection thing to a different level, where I'm not just connecting people to people now, I'm connecting people to resources to help them get closer to their goals and dreams. So it was at that point that I thought, what's the best way for me to start catalyzing this? And I said out loud, I'm going to write a New York Times bestseller on this. Within 6 days, I think, I had 5 agents reach out to me, like, no joke. And then I got to choose, which doesn't happen. I can tell you that for my first go around with my first book. And started on this journey to build the brand, to support the book, to write the book, to get all this information out there, to get to know an audience, understand what their true needs were, so I could really offer them value.
So now you're getting these influential people. People are seeing your world, right? And like you said, it's not that they want to replicate what you're doing, but they're, how are you doing this quietly behind the scenes and getting access to this? Because you're relatable. You're an everyday person to them, mm-hmm. that is doing things on an epic level and having access to things that most dream aren't possible. But you're almost doing it, not even realizing you're there, because you're so focused on the vision and kind of putting it out there. So you decide, okay, I'm going to start becoming this brand in a sense, and educating people through the tools that you've learned that could be effective for them. Now, with that being said, you end up speaking with a number of different people and spaces, creating unbelievable stories. In total, I'll let you kind of tell people about it, but 45 speakers, 7,000 people have tuned in to check this out, sign up for the class to learn about it. How did you come up with this idea, and how did you even get people to hear about it? Because you've been featured in a lot of publications for, I mean, some of the biggest names, HuffPost, Inc., I mean, CNN, all these different things for all your businesses. Why are people gravitating towards you?
I would love to know their answer. Honestly, I think what you're saying, if I want to like take my humility cap off for a second, is exactly it, that I am really unafraid to tell people the truth about my experience and pull the wool off of everyone's eyes and say, listen, yeah, here's all the shiny accolades and here's the highlight reel online, but like, let's talk truth. Here's the struggles. Here's what it took to get there. Like I have a lot of free stuff on my website, one of which is called The Shit No One Tells You About Starting a Business.
It was one of my favorite titles.
Thank you. Which, when I first published it, got changed in a lot of got edited. But I think it's stuff like that that people gravitate towards, because I think that I sit as this bridge builder between worlds, where I can sit like with Deepak Chopra and we can have these deep conversations, but I can be a translator for him of this like real spiritual esoteric stuff and bring it back down to earth. Or I can sit around like with my NBA player friend, Ronnie, who's in this virtual summit that you're referring to that had 7,000 people and 45 speakers. And we can talk from his plane as well. And I think because I can be an authentic chameleon, I really am able to synthesize in a way that people are like, oh, I really see what that takes. I really can relate to her. We're really not that different. And I'm able to curate it in one place for them. I think it just makes it more accessible.
And so these individuals that you're bringing their stories to almost see as you as like a mouthpiece for these folks. I mean, you're doing something right, because one of the free resources that I saw on your site that I found interesting was the 55 questions to break the ice and really get to know someone. And I want to make sure I read this accurately. It's been downloaded a million times.
Yeah, 1.2.
1.2. You got to throw in the 0.2. It makes a huge difference that day. When you start going to the millions, the 0.2 makes a difference.
Yeah.
Why? Like, why are people feeling so inclined to say, I want to download this?
I think people are craving real connection. We are in the quote unquote most connected time in our human history, but I believe it is actually the most disconnected time, because we're using these tools that I think actually have great value, like social media, but we're whittling them down to these ways that don't make us feel good and don't make us feel seen, heard, connected, and instead using them, like I said, for highlight reels and for really surface level connection. But I think that these are tools that can be really valuable. Like, you and I met because of a post that I had online.
Yeah.
Like, they really have value and can be valuable. But what people are really craving is true, deep connection. And so when I created this guide that people are downloading, and I talk about, hey, if we can break beyond the surface and we can break beyond the what do you do, because that makes people feel sized up and transacted and limited and judged, and instead we ask them other questions that are no harder to ask, but help someone be appreciated for who they are, not what they do, you'll get to what they do. That really helps build connection, rapport, and trust a lot more quickly, and helps people really want to be around you. Because at the end of the day, was it Carnegie who talked about the know, like, and trust people?
Mm-hmm.
It is, that remains true. And I think as long as humans are on this planet, I think will remain true that if you don't first know, but then like, and then trust, and that's has to work in that flow, the relationships don't happen. And we are relational social beings.
I mean, it definitely seems like you've kind of found your niche, your lane. And when you look at the success, and I say that not in the traditional way, success that's really has true substance to it, there's something or chord that you've hit with people that is making them gravitate towards you, whether it be the downloads, whether it be people coming in and checking out the online seminar, and then even things like, I believe it was called the Give It Forward movement.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll let you briefly touch on that, but I even saw the stats on that. I mean, you're constantly getting people to adopt whatever you're promoting, but you're not promoting it in the traditional way of a sales way. You're putting it out to the world and letting them adopt it and say, if you follow this, if you believe this is real, cool. If not, all good. But they seem to tend to kind of go towards the latter part.
Yeah. So Give It Forward is a movement. This is like a weird theme that sounds so ridiculous, but also happened by accident, where every time I was feeling in my adult life in some sort of rut or stuck, I would make a personal silent commitment to go out once a day for 30 days and intentionally help someone with no strings attached. And at one point, a couple summers ago, I put it on Facebook. This is another great use of social media. And I said, hey, this is a practice that I've had. Here's like a video I made about what this is. Does anyone want to join me in 30 days of giving? And I'm just going to call it Give It Forward. And hundreds of people, I think 300 something people, signed up to do it within 24 hours. And we started a little Facebook group just to talk and share stories and even help each other fulfill on the asks that people had. And then I just got so jazzed about it. And I was like, gosh, this is really powerful that the ripple effect of goodness can really go so far beyond what we'll ever know or see. So if I do something generous for you and you do it for someone else and that person for someone and someone and someone, it will eventually come back to you. And this is something I've always known intrinsically and anecdotally. I have evidence for it. However, Adam Grant's work, if you're familiar with him, he's one of the folks in the summit. I tremendously admire his work. And he, his first big book was called Give and Take. And he puts science behind what I just knew intrinsically, that givers win in this world as long as they're not martyrs. And that's really powerful. And I thought, if I can help catalyze for more people just acts of giving with no strings attached, it really helped me understand when people would come back to me and they'd say, it helped deepen my relationships. It helped me recognize that I had a lot of power and value within myself that I was really taking for granted. And it helps take the attention off yourself. Because one of the things Deepak has said to me in one of our many videos is when we are feeling anxious and stressed, aside from not being present, one of the biggest reasons for that is that we are me-focused. The second you turn from me-focused to others-focused is the moment when it disappears. And that is what Give It Forward has demonstrated to me.
How much of an impact has Deepak had in a lot of your kind of mindset and thought on these things?
A lot.
Was it something that you previously had, or he kind of just took what you had and just expanded it tremendously?
Yeah, I definitely had the foundations. Yeah. And Deepak and my work together has been about a year now. And it, through our friendship, he has been like the greatest mentor I have ever had. And he doesn't even consider himself my mentor. But just being in such close proximity to him so frequently, I've learned so much that is so invaluable. But it has always just been this like next level or 10x level of what I already knew. Because here's the thing. I think we go out into the world so often, especially me as someone who values learning and growing as some of my highest values, always looking for outside input and data to build on. And what I've come to realize is that it is in us already. We just have to slow down enough to see it and access it. And so someone like Deepak, certainly I'm learning from him, but I'm also just seeing that enacted, and that is really powerful.
I mean, I think, look, you have a lot of people that have entrusted you to speak on things, to be part of your series. There's some form of authenticity there. And like you said, I think when we first started the conversation, you know who you are. You're being true to you. You're not trying to be somebody else. And you stood out when you were younger. You did all these things that weren't the norm in a lot of ways. But that's what people typically gravitate towards, because it's so rare, I feel like, that when people do get it presented to them, they want to take it. They want to be a part of it.
Well, thank you.
So with that being said, you have all these things going on. Videos with Deepak, summits online, coaching, you name it, resources, guides, articles. What is next for you? Do you even know what's next for you? Or is it going to be one of these things that just naturally occur and you just run with it?
Both. The book will be next, but it won't be in the soon future. It'll be a couple years. So that's like a long-term horizon. But my one goal for 2019 was to have less goals. And it was
it's really interesting.
It's because I am so used to being a planner. I have this very elaborate New Year's structure and procedure I would go through of creating mantras for the year and goals and vision boards and narrating it. And I still think those can be wonderful. But coming into this year, I thought, you know what? I just want to let life unfold a little bit and move in that direction and be in the flow of that. And it doesn't mean that I don't have intentions. Like, you know, I'd love to have more shows like the one with Deepak, and my partner and I are starting a podcast on love with high profile people. And these are things that will be next, but I'm holding a lot more loosely to them.
So for people listening today that listen to this podcast and they want to learn how to live their life by design, right, and not by default, how do they get started?
Well, I have a lot of free resources if we want to bring them there. But more tactically, a lot of it is the pausing and recognizing, am I living on someone else's definition of success, or is this mine? And often it takes a lot of deprogramming to really know the truth to that answer. And then doing certain simple exercises to question and know, what do I really want for myself? And so I've alluded to two of those, but more specifically, one is this friendship exercise that I love, where it's a set of 7 or 9 questions that you ask to people who you know and trust from different arenas of your life. And through that, they're telling you things like, my greatest wish for you is, or you're at your best when, or you're at your lowest when, or here's something I think I know about you that you don't know about yourself. And you take these data points, and also it's not reciprocal, which is a really important element, because if it's reciprocal, there's often fear of what you're going to say in return, and they're not necessarily going to be as candid with you. So it's an unreciprocated either email or phone conversation. I like over email because you can keep the data. And then I look across and I say, where are their patterns? What stands out to me? What seems true that I really need to take? And then I partner that with my own sieve of instinct and intuition of like, what do I really want to take from this and how do I want to implement it? And then secondarily, I really like whenever you're in a position of transition and you're thinking, what do I want the next to look like? I'll talk career in this case, to carry around a notebook or write in an Evernote or something that works for you. Everything that comes to mind that you loved when you were a child, that you gravitated towards, that you're exceptionally good at, that people come to you for seeking guidance in, and even things that make you jealous, because each of those things are cues. And then once you're done with the brainstorming, I've done this for as long as 30 days before without judgment, I go back and I think, okay, how do I piece together these seemingly arbitrary and random things in ways that maybe I've not even seen in the world or as a job? And just start playing with them. And then from there, often I think what needs to happen is that there's, again, this looseness of saying, could I try that? Could I see that somewhere? Could I dabble in that? And just testing so that you don't have to say, I'm putting my stake in the ground. This is the thing that I'm holding on to. I'm going to do everything it takes to create that. Because sometimes then you might choose something that you don't actually really want to pursue. Yeah. But you can learn that more quickly.
And this kind of goes back to your being open-minded, kind of going with the flow. So with that being said, I don't want to give away too much information because there is a lot on the site, a lot of the collateral. If people want to learn more about what you're doing, what you have coming up, about yourself, this is kind of the plug. Shout out the Instagram, the website, all that work. Thank you.
Well, it's all my name. So it's Darrah.co, Darrah.co. On Instagram, every single day, I'm posting something that I hope is of value. It's Darrah B, like the letter. Same thing on Twitter. It's really easy to find. If you go to the website, you can find the Deepak series. We've got a ton of free resources. There's a masterclass with Deepak and myself on living a more meaningful life that also comes with a guided meditation. There's the Shit No One Tells You About Starting a Business free guide. There's a free guide, like we talked about, on the 55 best questions to ask to break the ice and really get to know someone. And there's also one on the 6 best steps for more effective goal planning. So trying to sort of hit these 3 buckets for you. There's also hundreds of articles interviewing everyone from Shaq and Jillian Michaels and Robert Herjavec to, you know, people like you and me who are not celebrity names that have a lot of value to bring to the table.
Well, I must say, I'm motivated to do some shit with my life after hearing everything you have going on. you know, so with everybody, what they've heard today, if you can kind of leave people with one thing, what is the one thing that you'd want people to walk away with this interview with?
I'm just gonna say the first thing that comes to my mind, which is to be your own biggest cheerleader. That people are not going to open doors for you, that you have to come ready and willing and able, and that there's not this like white knight on a horse that's going to come in for you and save you. You have to do the work. You have to be there. And then people can help you and they can open doors, but you have to do the work. You have to be prepared. You have to say yes, and you have to know how to ask. So it does come back to you, although the people around you are certainly, certainly important.
Darrah, this has been a fun one for me. Likewise. I love what you've done. I'm excited for the future. I'm excited for the book. You have my word. I will buy a copy the second it comes out, multiple copies. Everybody needs to read it. I'll drop the date on it. But no, I mean, I think it's to see what you've done is super impressive. But to do something with passion, purpose, and just do it because it's right and it's good. And obviously, your message is resonating. So congrats on all your success. Appreciate you coming in.
Thank you. I really appreciate you.
Once again, I'm your host, Justin Epstein, and thank you for listening to Culturation. As always, this show has been powered by Premiere.